Chapter 46. Colonel Morton Hollis wasn't overjoyed at leaving his family in the middle of his wife's birthday party. The understanding look in her eyes wrenched his gut. The cost would hit him dearly, he knew. The red coral necklace was about to be enhanced by the 5-day cruise to the Bahamas she'd always pestered him about. He sat at a desk in a specially designed office compartment inside the C-140 transport, flying south over Venezuela. He puffed away deeply on a large Havana cigar he had purchased at the base store, now that the embargo on Cuban imports had been lifted. Hollis studied the latest weather reports on the Antarctic Peninsula and peered at photographs showing the rugged, icy coastline. He'd already run over the difficulties in his mind a dozen times since takeoff. During their brief history, the newly formed Special Operations Forces had already achieved a notable record, but they had yet to tackle a major rescue of the magnitude of the Lady Flamborough hijacking. The orphan child of the Pentagon, the Special Operations Forces were not molded into a single command until the fall of 1989. At that time, the Army's Delta Force, whose fighters were drawn from the elite Ranger and Green Beret units and a secret aviation unit known as Task Force 160, merged with the top-of-the-line Navy SEAL Team 6 and the Air Force's Special Operations Wing. The unified forces cut across service rivalries and boundaries and became a separate command, numbering 12,000 men, headquartered at a tightly restricted base in southeast Virginia. The crack fighters were heavily trained in guerrilla tactics, parachuting, wilderness survival, and scuba diving, with special emphasis on storming buildings, ships, and aircraft for rescue missions. Hollis was short. He'd barely met the height requirements of the special forces, and almost as wide in the shoulders as he was tall. 40 years old, but immensely tough, he had survived a rigorous simulated guerrilla war in the swamps of Florida for 3 weeks, and parachuted right back in for another exercise. His closely cropped brown hair was thin and graying early. His eyes were a blue-green, the whites slightly yellowed from too much time in the sun without proper glasses. An astute man who always looked over the next hill and planned accordingly, he left very little to chance. He blew a smoke ring from the cigar with a degree of elation. He couldn't be leading a better team if he'd picked the medal winners of a military Olympics. They were the elite of the elite for fighting low-intensity conflicts. The 80 men of his team, who called themselves the Demon Stalkers, were selected for the Lady Flamborough rescue because they actually had engaged in winter assault exercises against mock terrorists who had held a ship and crew hostages off the coast of Norway. 40 were shooters, while the other half acted as logistical and support fighters. His second-in-command, Major John Dillinger, rapped on the door and stuck his head in. "You busy, Mort?" he asked in a decided Texas twang. Hollis waved a casual hand. "My office is your office," he assured Dillinger jovially. "Squeeze in and sit yourself in my new French leather designer couch." Dillinger, a lean, stringy man with a pinched face, but hard as an anvil, stared dubiously at the canvas seat bolted to the floor and sat down. Forever kidded about being saddled with the same name as the famous bank robber, he was a master of the art of tactical planning and the penetration of almost impossible defenses. "Covering the bases?" he asked Hollis. "Going over meteorological forecasts, ice and terrain conditions. See any jazz in your crystal ball?" "Too early." Hollis raised an eyebrow. "What plans are you forming in your perverted mind?" "I can recite and draw pictures of 6 different ways to board a ship by stealth. I've already familiarized myself with the design and deck layout of the Lady Flamborough, but until we learn whether we're coming in by parachute, by scuba, or by foot from hard beach or ice, I can only plot an outline." Hollis nodded solemnly. "Over 100 innocent people are on that ship. 2 presidents and the Secretary General of the United Nations. God help us if one steps in our line of fire." "We can't go in with blanks," Dillinger said caustically. "No, and we can't drop from noisy helicopters with all weapons blasting. We've got to infiltrate before the hijackers know we're there. Complete surprise is crucial. Then we hit 'em by stealth parachute at night." "Could be," Hollis acknowledged tersely. Dillinger shifted uncomfortably in the canvas seat. A night landing is dangerous enough, but dropping blindly on a darkened ship can mean slaughter. You know it, and I know it, Mort. Out of 40 men, 15 will miss the target and fall in the sea. 20 will sustain injuries impacting on hard, protruding surfaces of the ship. I'll be lucky to have 5 men in fighting trim. We can't rule it out. Let's wait until more info comes in, suggested Dillinger. Everything hinges on where the ship is found. Whether she's moored or sailing across the sea makes all the difference in the world. As soon as we receive word on her final status, I'll formulate a tight assault plan and lay it in your hands for final approval.
Fair enough, said Hollis agreeably. How are the men?
Doing their homework. By the time we land at Punta Arenas, they'll have memorized the Lady Flamborough well enough to run around her decks blindfolded.
A lot is riding on them this time out.
They'll do the job. The trick is to get them on board in one piece.
There is one thing, Hollis said, a deep apprehension on his face. The latest estimate from intelligence sources on the strength of the hijackers. It just came in from the Pentagon.
How many are we talking about? 5, 10, maybe 12?
Hollis hesitated.
Assuming the crew of the Mexican ore carrier that boarded the cruise ship are also armed, we could be looking at a total of 40.
Dillinger gaped.
Oh, my God. We're going up against an equal number of terrorists?
Looks that way, Hollis nodded grimly.
Dillinger shook his head in shocked disapproval and drew a hand across his forehead. Then his eyes burned into Hollis's.
Some people, he said disgustedly, are going to get their butts stomped before this caper is over.
Deep in a concrete bunker tunneled into a hill outside Washington, D.C., Lieutenant Samuel T. Jones came rushing into a large office, panting as though he'd just run a 200-meter dash, which indeed he had, only 2 steps shy of the exact distance from the communications room to the photo analysis office. His face was flushed with excitement, and he held a huge photograph spread between his upraised hands. Jones had often rushed along the corridors during crisis exercise drills, but he and the other 300 men and women who worked in the Special Operations Forces Readiness Command hadn't really put their hearts into it until now. Practice did not make the adrenaline pump like the real thing. After waiting like hibernating groundhogs, they had erupted into life when the alert on the Lady Flamborough hijacking came in from the Pentagon. Major General Frank Dodge headed up the SOF. He and several members of his staff were tensely awaiting the arrival of the latest satellite image depicting the waters south of Tierra del Fuego when Jones burst into the room.
Got it!
Dodge gave the young officer a stern look for unmilitary enthusiasm.
Should have been here 8 minutes ago, he grunted.
My fault, General. I took the liberty of trimming the outer perimeters and enlarging the immediate search area before having it computer-enhanced. Dodge's stern expression softened, and he nodded approvingly.
Good thinking, Lieutenant.
Jones gave a short sigh and quickly clipped the newest satellite image on a long wall board under a row of hooded spotlights. An earlier image hung nearby, showing the Lady Flamborough's last known position circled in red, her previous course marked in green, and predicted course in orange. Jones stepped back as General Dodge and his officers crowded around the image, peering anxiously for the tiny dot indicating the cruise ship. The last satellite sighting put the ship about 100 kilometers south of Cape Horn, said a major, tracing the course from the previous chart. She should be well out into Drake's Passage by now, approaching the islands off the Antarctic Peninsula. After nearly a full minute of appraisal, General Dodge turned to Jones.
Did you study the photo, Lieutenant?
No, sir, I didn't take the time. I rushed it over as quickly as possible.
You're certain this is the latest transmission?
Jones looked puzzled.
Yes, sir.
No mistake?
None, Jones replied unhesitatingly. The NUMA CSAT satellite recorded the area with digital electronic impulses that were sent to ground stations instantaneously. You're seeing an image no more than 6 minutes old.
When will the next photo come in?
The Landsat should orbit the region in 40 minutes.
And the Casper?
Jones glanced at his watch. If she returns on schedule, we should be looking at film in 4 hours.
Get it to me the instant it arrives.
Yes, sir.
Dodge turned to his subordinates. "Well, gentlemen, the White House ain't going to like this." He went over and picked up a phone. "Put me through to Alan Mercier." The National Security Advisor's voice came over the line within 20 seconds. "I hope you've got some good news, Frank." "Sorry, no," Dodge answered flatly. "It appears the cruise ship..." "She sank?" Mercier cut him off. "We can't say with any certainty." "What are you saying?" Dodge took a breath. "Please inform the President the Lady Flamborough has vanished again."